Welcome to the Blue Stocking Circle podcast, Lady Nerds on Popular Culture. We're your hosts, Griselle,
Ashley, and Bea.
And this is episode 4, Persuasion. Today we pay tribute to that renowned lady author, Jane Austen, by sharing our thoughts on one of my favorite books, Persuasion. But first, a warning. I think the statute of limitations has run out on this one, but if you really don't want to be spoiled, take a break and go read the novel or watch one of the two film adaptations, 1995 or 2007. It's Austen's second shortest novel, so it won't take you that long. Now let's get some knowledge up in hither. It's important to note that Persuasion is Austen's last completed novel, Sanditon being her last unfinished work before she passed away. So it was published posthumously alongside Northanger Abbey 6 months after her death in 1817. As such, it sets a very different tone from her other works. Anne is not the hopeful heroine of Austen's earlier works. She is a woman who has seen something of society and found it wanting. Some believe it to be the most autobiographical of Austen's works, though there is plenty of debate about the details. Little survives about her personal life. What letters remain, 160 of them, mostly written to her sister and her niece, reveal glimpses of her personal life, but not much relating to her affairs beyond the domestic. And there is very little in them regarding her writing. Some critics believe that the letters are incomplete, censored by her sister Cassandra after Jane's death. The truth is, we have little but her novels to recommend her. Now, whether Persuasion reveals anything about Austen's own experience with love, family, and regret, we can do little more than speculate, though it certainly reveals her views on Bath with no remorse. Seriously, she is famed for hating Bath, and it's ironic that the Jane Austen Center is housed there. Of Anne Elliot, Jane Austen wrote in one of her surviving letters to her niece Fanny, "You," she writes, "may perhaps like the heroine, as she is almost too good for me." According to critic Claire Harmon, submissive, dutiful, passive Anne seems not to come from the same pen as Elizabeth Bennet or Emma Woodhouse, having none of their charm and sex appeal and attendant optimism. All Austen's novels revolve around single women moving or maneuvering toward marriage, but Anne Elliot is the only really spinsterish one, self-appointedly and disappointedly unmarried, end quote. And with that, let us proceed to the newbie summary, wherein Lady B will relate the plot of Persuasion for lovers and haters alike.
First, I would like to say that I refuse to be referred to as anything other than Lady B from this point on, unless you wish to promote me in rank. As for the summary, here goes. Literally rich but figuratively poor Anne Elliot, age 27, is ignored by her vain father and arrogant older sister and used by her hypochondriac younger sister. Unloved since her mother's death when she was just 14, Anne clings to the memory of the dashing Captain Frederick Wentworth, to whom she was briefly engaged in her late teens, before being persuaded to end the engagement by a well-intentioned but misguided family friend, the estimable Lady Russell. Nearly a decade later, Anne and Wentworth are thrown together again by a twist of fate. Will their love be rekindled, or will it be extinguished forever in the face of charming sisters, courting cousins, years of resentment and regret, and, most perilous of all, stone steps? TLDR, Jane Austen's Cinderella.
Which is totally true, and I didn't see that before.
I feel like that could be written on the back of the next edition of Persuasion.
Yes, it's a perfect blurb.
That's a perfect blurb. Like, well done, Lady B.
Thank you.
So let's dive right into our origin stories, and we'll start with me as the hostess, I suppose. Though Persuasion is my favorite Austen novel, it was the last of her completed works that I read. Pride and Prejudice was my gateway, though it was not until college after seeing the 1995 miniseries, holla back to blockbuster days, that I read Austen for the first time. Pride and Prejudice I devoured, Sense and Sensibility I adored, Emma I enjoyed. I was meh about Northanger Abbey, though we have feelings about that on the podcast.
We certainly do.
We certainly do. And I absolutely hated Mansfield Park, and still do, not gonna lie. After that, I wasn't sure I was ready for Persuasion, so imagine my delight when I found myself hooked from the very start. I wanted to know everything about Kellynch and sweet, unappreciated Anne. She was all the best of Lizzie, Eleanor, and Emma rolled into one, but older, wiser, a heroine I could relate to as an introverted 20-something. Reading it for the first time, I felt I had found a kindred spirit, and Anne's story is just as good today as it was then. Every time I read it, I find something new to love and some element I didn't notice before. It's a book that continues to grow with me. Ladies?
I've read Persuasion so often, and the first time that I read it was so long ago, I honestly do not remember details. I know my mom bought me the Scholastic version of Pride and Prejudice at a book fair when I was in fifth grade. I still have it. It's like the green cover with an introduction by someone. It's great. I'll find it and we'll put it in the show notes. So I'm going to be very confident in saying that I'm going to date it to around fifth grade because, as with many people, Pride and Prejudice was my gateway and I just tore through the rest of them in, you know, 6 months or something. So I do remember thinking that it was more romantic than Pride and Prejudice, because you have these two lovers who have been longing for each other for years. And I remember kind of thinking it was very Romeo and Juliet-esque, like the star-crossed lovers. Luckily for them, there's a happier ending than Romeo and Juliet. So that's what I can remember. I could not tell you anything more than that. Because one of my copies of Persuasion is red to bits. You know, the edges are falling off. My other two copies are nice and pristine. Haven't destroyed them yet.
Okay, I don't seem like much of a Jane Knight compared to you two, but Jane Austen is one of my idols, as you both know. The issue is that while she was brilliant, she was not exactly prolific. Pride and Prejudice was also my gateway to Austen. I read it in high school and enjoyed it very much, and have since read another one of her novels every few years as an occasional treat. I was planning to leave Persuasion for last, but clearly that plan has been altered, so now I have only Mansfield Park left of her completed works, which I understand from you two is not going to be a case of saving the best for last.
You might need to revisit Pride and Prejudice as a palate cleanser after Mansfield Park.
Oh, no. So we're going to dive right into Ship Wars. And there are so many thoughts that we have to share. I came up with a couple of themes here. Firstly, I wanted to do a Battle of the Austen Gents, because what are we if we don't have some sort of quiz-like theme? So, ladies, break it down. What do you think? I am a total Wentworth lover. I love Wentworth. I love him. You can't stop me from loving him. I think he was wrong, and he learned his lesson, and that is always to be appreciated in men.
Okay, I'm glad you said he was wrong, because the reason that I cannot love Wentworth is because I just, every time I read it, I think, why? Why were you so pig-headed and stubborn? And it wasn't when Anne broke up with him. I understand being upset. It was 2 years later when he tells her, oh, I had already forgiven you, but had I come back and talked to you, would you have taken me back? And she said, yes, of course. And he was like, oh, I'm so stupid. I was like, yeah, you were, because what changed between that time and, you know, the present? Because you were the one to also initiate. I get that he was young, too, in his early 20s, and she was 18, 19, he was a little bit older, right?
Yeah, I think he's only about 2 to 3 years older than she is. I think when she's 27, he's like 30.
Okay, so I get it. You're 20, you're 21, you're young, you're brash, you're, you know, you think that the world is yours, so you're going to make stupid decisions because we all do. I get it, but I just want to shake him every time because he and Anne deserved each other and he left her hanging for 4 years while he was off having adventures, because let's not even discuss all the things he could have gotten up to while he was sailing around the world. So I love him, but if we're talking about Wentworth or Darcy, because at least it didn't take him, you know, 6 years to realize it was wrong. It only took him...
He saw her fine eyes and knew.
It only took him like 6 to 8 months or so, which I think is a much better time frame.
It's true.
I do not care for Wentworth. That line about how she was so altered he would not have recognized her, oh, he was a jerk.
That was mean.
It was
mean. That is a harsh line. I do sometimes interpret it a little differently, more so than a, like not so much a put down, as like he knew her when she was...
Vivacious and happier.
Like, he saw something in her when she was younger, and she's kind of lost that spark. So that's kind of how I read that. But yes, it comes off as like, what?
He made a poor impression on me. And there's a line in the beginning that says they basically fell in love because he was bored and she was lonely. And that's not a great foundation for a relationship, although I suppose it is a realistic one.
I mean, yes, I go back and forth, because this time when I read it, that line struck me, doesn't always. And I remember thinking, oh yeah, that sounds really bad, but just because those were the circumstances doesn't necessarily mean that it was not true love. This time when I read it, I was kind of like, I really wanted them to get together, so I felt bad that...
The idea of, you know, he was bored, she was just like there, and that line gets me to thinking about introverts and extroverts. Like, would these two have even really gotten to know one another had he not just been hanging out around with his brother, not really doing much else? Would his personality ever have really sought out somebody with her personality? Because they would not really have engaged otherwise. Like, she wasn't the girl who would go to the balls or the country dances, and he would have normally been off out and about doing whatever gallivanting 18th century thing boys used to do. So you know, is that like the star-crossed lover angle in this story where, were it not for them being in the right place at the right time, those two personalities may never have come together. They would have been a little too different, especially at 21 and 19 or however old they were originally.
I don't think their incompatibility is so much their introversion versus extroversion. Those kind of personalities blend really well together. They balance each other out. I think it's more one of the lines that Anne says herself in the book, or she thinks rather. She thinks that she had only meant to oppose the too common idea of spirit and gentleness being incompatible with each other. I agree with that. She has this whole argument against it, but he has spirit. She's on the gentle side, obviously. When that happens, one person dominates the relationship. The other person sort of follows along, and that does not end well. I don't know how it's going to work out for them, but I wish them well. I did like them. At the end of the story, I did like them. This is not a ship where I was angry that they ended up together like in Jane Eyre. But at the same time, I don't know if it's the most compatible relationship in fiction.
Going off what you just said, the idea that one person is going to dominate the relationship, it's not going to end well. Yes, I think you're right. But I think with them, it might work, given that Anne has been trained literally her whole life to be dominated by the people in her life. It was her mother, and then it was her father and Lady. Because Lady Russell cares for her, but Lady Russell dominates her. So in a, I guess I'm going to take the part this time of like cheering Anne Wentworth on. That might be the part that I play. I think it might work for them because if Anne has been conditioned to do that and she's a very patient, very kind of giving person, it might not be so bad if the person that is dominating her cares about her and listens to her. So I guess the question then becomes, how much is Wentworth going to realize that that's part of her personality and try to accommodate his personality for it?
I think one of the things that I love about Persuasion, and which I think is what makes the relationship work in the end for me, is more so that Anne has had, what is it, like, they've been apart for like 7 years?
Six or seven years
at this point.
It was eight.
It was a significant amount of time. She's in her late 20s at this stage. And you don't see that normally, especially with any of Jane Austen's novels. Like, everybody gets married right away, very young, and they don't have the chance to grow. And while it was the norm to get married at, like, you know, as soon as you've been put out into society, Anne chooses not to do that. She turns down multiple marriages after that. It's like two other offers that are made to her, and she turns them down, and she chooses to remain a spinster. I think she's grown and she's learned, and that growth, being with her father, seeing his behavior. One of the things I don't like about the adaptations is that they make it almost seem like she's following the family line of like thinking herself better than others, and she's aloof, and they don't show her introversion as introversion, but more as like social aloofness from people beneath her class. Whereas I think in the book, she sees how ridiculous her family is, and she sees that their behavior is wrong, and that this way that they have about, you know, interacting, like even with her sister, because she married beneath her, like the guy that she married, he's not a baronet, so he's not as good enough for them. So I feel like that time away from each other and her finally being able to see that Lady Russell is wrong, that her father is wrong, that her mother maybe would have not been entirely correct in her own happiness, I think that lends her the character that she needs to be able to then balance out Wentworth. And at one point she says, she has that line when she's talking, so she's talking to Harville, and she says that line about how women love longer, or like they're able to hold out longer. I don't remember the exact term, but it's something like that. So I think that is what lends her the character she needs to be able to make this relationship. That's my stance. I think
the line is,
I love them.
The only advantage I claim for my sex, and is not a great one, that we love the longest when all hope of love is gone.
Yes, it's so sad. I love the drama.
Okay, I have a question for B. Since we were talking about the introverts and the extroverts, and with Darcy and Elizabeth, it's a flip because Darcy is the introvert and Elizabeth is the extroverted one. So do you think the same about their relationship that you do with them?
No, I don't, because I think we're looking at two different qualities here. I love Darcy and Lizzie, actually. Darcy is very introverted. Elizabeth is very extroverted, I think. Although I've seen arguments that she's an introvert, I don't think so. She's always at girls' balls, dancing around, giggling, laughing. She's an extrovert. It's not the introversion, extroversion that's an incompatibility, as I just said. It's another dimension of personality that we can call emotional stability versus emotional reactivity, or we can call, in these terms from the novel, gentleness versus spirit. Darcy and Lizzie are both very spirited people. They're both very strong characters. They will fight each other. They do fight each other. That has tension, but it also, they get along well because they're both can understand each other, can relate to each other's perspective.
Annoyed and aroused at the same time.
Exactly. It's a potent combination. Whereas where you have, again, one stronger character, one less strong character. I don't like relationships like that. It's just a personal preference. In my fiction, I like the Ron and Hermione, Darcy and Lizzie, always bantering or arguing back and forth type. That's what I prefer. So maybe it's just a matter of my perspective.
So then do we think that it's actually in Anne and Wentworth's best interest that they had the whole issue and they waited 8 years? Because I think there's something we said about Griselle said that she's given that time to grow.
That's what I love about Persuasion, that it is so different from any other novel you would have read at the time, where she chooses to be a spinster. She's fine with being on her own. She doesn't need to get married. She doesn't even need to marry Wentworth at the end. She'll be taken care of no matter what, as opposed to some of other characters right. in Austen's works. So I think that time to grow, to mature, to get to know herself, because I really don't think Anne knew herself at 19. Lady Russell could have been right. She just kind of impulsively, you know, felt the passion of first love and went with it. I think then with the time away, she got to realize that if it was true love and being able to get back to it, that's another dimension.
So, and now I kind of think, yeah, that I think B's right in where they would not have worked had they gotten married at 19 and 21. But now I'm thinking, yeah, the 27 and 29 or 27, however old they are at the end, is a much better situation for them because she spent 10 years saying no to Lady Russell, saying no to her dad in the most basic, I don't want to get married to Charles and to my cousin and everyone else.
And even just with the economizing of the family, like she's always fighting her dad at every step, even though they don't appreciate what she's doing. But she's been able to like build that spine and strength of character to do that. Okay, so if I like Wentworth, Ashley likes Darcy, and, you know, B likes neither of these, anyone?
I like Darcy, but I am Darcy. I'd be the one hiding in the corner of the party because my friends dragged me there, thinking tolerable, I suppose, but not handsome enough to tempt me. I don't know. I prefer men who believe in things like women should vote and own property and wear pants. So none of the Jane Austen heroes really appeal to me very much. I'm sorry. I know that's blasphemy.
No, I'm trying to think if there's anyone in there that... I'm trying to think who the most progressive is, but no one quite enough to get you to say
maybe
that.
Maybe if I had to pick, if forced to choose... Colonel Brandon.
Oh, good choice.
Colonel Brandon, because he's devoted to the people he loves. He will fight for you and he will win because he has that military experience. He appreciates music. But on the other hand, he falls in love with a girl half his age because she reminded him of his teenage sweetheart. That's kind of creepy.
That is kind of creepy. That's always been creepy.
So I don't know. Maybe I haven't read Mansfield Park or Sanditon. Maybe I'll find my Jane Austen hero in those.
I can accept this.
We'll revisit.
We'll revisit. There will be more Austens to read. So with that... ladies, let us go into our feminist rants.
Ooh, can I start ranting?
Go for it.
I have a capital R rant because I've been holding this in since I read The Arm of the Starfish when I was 12 at least. Before I start, I should probably note that I am going to spoil, vaguely, a whole bunch of classic children's series as well as works that we've previously discussed on this podcast, so be aware of that. Also, I would like to preface my statement just in case by stating, one, again, I idolize Jane Austen. Two, I grew up watching A Great Marriage. And three, I have never felt rage like I felt when my OTP's marriage was retconned. So I am not against marriage either in reality or in fiction. That being said, here we go. I despise the marriage plot. I'm not talking about the book of that title, but I'm talking about the standard plot that we know all too well, which is centered around the courtship of a couple culminating in their marriage. This is, of course, the Jane Austen plot. And it has hung over 2+ centuries of fiction, almost always works with female protagonists. My issue with the marriage plot is that most of the time, nearly all of the time, marriage is seen as the only possible ending for female protagonists, a sort of default be-all, end-all conclusion. It doesn't matter whether they say they want to get married or not. It doesn't matter whether they are aspiring writers, or teenage science nerds, or revolutionary icons who flinch at the idea of having children, or waitresses who tell us 5 minutes into their story that all they want is their own restaurant and turn down marriage proposals twice, but still wind up with a fiancé and a furry fetus and no restaurants. All of these characters are married or at least engaged at the end of their stories, usually with children, and at the expense of everything they spent 500 pages, 3 books, or 10 hours telling us they wanted. And it isn't the fact that they're married and have children that bothers me. You can pry the blithe marriage and children from my cold, dead hands.
Preach.
My issue is first that it almost always happens to a female protagonist as if it were the only possible ending to their stories, whereas it is the exception rather than the rule for a male protagonist. For example, the Harry Potter epilogue is a rare exception. Second, the women's roles as wives and mothers end up nullifying all their professional and personal ambitions, which we've become invested in over the course of their stories. And what bothers me regarding Jane Austen in particular is that she is perhaps the most famous, successful single woman of all time, And yet she married off every single one of her protagonists and ended the story there, like there was nothing else of importance left to tell. Real women's lives and goals do not end at marriage or motherhood, so why should the stories and aspirations of fictional women do so? And I would like to add that Jane Austen, the person, is 1,000 times more interesting to me than any of her heroines. If they had been real people, we would not still be talking about Elizabeth or Eleanor or Emma today. But here we are, still talking about Jane Austen 2 centuries later. I wish she had written even just one protagonist like herself and defied the marriage plot for once. Let Anne Elliot get over some guy she knew for 6 months when she was 19 and realize her self-worth all on her own. Like you said, Griselle, she did not need to get married. Emma Woodhouse did not need to get married. These stories could have had different outcomes. Maybe if the marriage plot had been defined in these novels just once, our female protagonist wouldn't still be stuck in it over 2 centuries later.
We need a moment. I completely agree, and I do feel the same way about a lot of the marriage plot novels. I know that within the time period and the time when Jane Austen was writing her own experiences, what little we know, I know that that definitely has an impact. It's harder for a female writer to have been revolutionary and, you know, leave her character as a completely independent woman. Especially at that time, it was generally the fates of independent women were not that great. I will say that Anne or Emma would have been fine. Lizzie would have had some trouble because her house was encumbered. She would have been dependent and she had no brothers. Eleanor would have been dependent and Marianne on a... And the little girl whose name I was forgetting.
Margaret.
Margaret, because she's like the background character. They would have been dependent on their brother who was
married to
a jerk and married to a witch. So that would not have been a great future for them either. But I can definitely say that yes, Anne, probably Emma would have been completely fine. Their houses were not encumbered. They would have been taken care of. There would have been no issue with them just living at home and being independent of any man. It would have been a radical change. Jane Austen was writing as a lady author anonymously.
And I want to say I completely agree, and we can discuss, I have 2 points. We can totally discuss the marriage plot and the Joan March problem. But first, just not a defense of Jane Austen, but just kind of maybe food for thought. Like you said, she was writing as a woman, she was writing anonymously, so she didn't have a lot of power on her own. Jane was really, she was a poor spinster. She was the Miss Bates of, mm-hmm. of all of the characters in her novel. The idea of the daughter of, you know, the village rector, the father dies, so mm-hmm. then now you're dependent on your brothers and your male relatives for charity, mm-hmm. and that charity can very easily go out the window, such as it is, when that brother has a change in circumstance. Mm-hmm. So the world that she was writing within, I think, is important to keep in context, because in some way, I think the reason that she married all these characters off was to give them the financial stability she didn't have. So for her, the marriage was, oh, happily ever after, because she didn't have that. She didn't have, okay, I can do what I want. And maybe that's, some people said maybe that's why she was only able to publish 6 novels, because between the moving from house to house, moving from, I forget where she was born, but then moving to the Stevenson Rectory, and then moving to Bath, and then moving with another cousin, moving back to Bath, and then because you have to follow the money around such as it is, maybe that's why she married them off. And then she died, I think she was 41?
She was young.
She was young when she died. And she had just started, you know, becoming successful and earning money on her own, because I think the first... her first novel, the money went to her brother because he was the one that went to the publisher and did all
She had to go through other people in order to get her work published. And the first one she sold was Northanger Abbey, and it was not published.
Right. So I think at the time that she died, when she was kind of like at the height of, not the height, she was reaching that, okay, I can see the height of like, I can actually support myself by my pen on my own in a comfortable position. Maybe had she not died, we would have seen a change in how she was writing her characters. Because we only have 6 full novels. Like we said before, that's not a lot. So, you know, 6 novels in, what, written in 20 years? Maybe she had picked up the pace after when she had a room of her own, as Virginia Woolf says, many years later. Maybe the characters would have been a little different. I totally agree with the marriage plot. I just kind of feel bad. I just kind of, like, want to throw that out there in defense of Jane, because I love her so much.
I love her, too. Maybe she could have gone autobiographical for once and shown that success does not depend on marriage necessarily. Even if it does require the help or assistance of male relatives, that's still a different avenue.
I don't think Jane was happy. I think what we have of her in her letters, she didn't own her success. It wasn't like published very widely that these were her writings. I think they were anonymous up until her death. I could be wrong. I could be getting my facts mixed up. Her letters are not cheerful things. So I don't think she was happy in her success. I think in many ways this was wish fulfillment for her. and what could have been the independence. I think that, you know, when she gives Anne that second chance, it is believed that it's the most autobiographical because there is some speculation that there was a marriage proposal that she turned down and always
the next morning, right.
And then what could it have been like had she had her home, had she been able to just exactly sit down and write, or, you know, have a family if that's what she wanted, or whatever it was that true happiness would have meant for her. I think her dependence did not sit well with her. She did also really, like, you get little bits and pieces within her novels of the writers that she admired. You don't get a lot about Fanny Burney, but Fanny Burney was one of her biggest influences. Mm. And Fanny Burney was, like, set. She was well-read, she was rich, she was good, and I think in some ways Jane maybe sought that kind of fame and couldn't really have the joy that came along with it because she didn't have the financial or even just the home stability.
Have you guys seen the movie Becoming Jane?
Yes.
It's not the best movie out there. Anne Hathaway's accent, not that I can do accents, but leaves a lot to be desired, but I did like the scene that they included with her talking to Mrs. Radcliffe, especially since Northanger Abbey parodies so much of the Mysteries of Udolpho and all that. But I think there was a lot in there about how Miss Radcliffe is saying that she's not happy. You know what I mean? It was so hard back then for women. And she was a successful writer.
Yeah.
So I feel like it was just so hard for women back then
to
have anything.
To hide behind the misses when you were a writer.
But that's exactly my point. Yeah. Why couldn't Catherine Woolen be the next Mrs. Radcliffe? Why couldn't she write novels after her marriage to Tony? It's not that I'm against the marriage. It's that that's it. That's seen as the ending for them. There is nothing else. You get married and you live happily ever after. And I know this is a weird thing and a hypocritical thing to say from the fairy tale fanatic in the group, but I am on the record as saying that the princess are the worst part of fairy tales.
Oh. Well, okay, I totally agree with you. And my issue with the marriage plot, not so much in the Jane Austen novels, because I think there's a lot to be said too about how ironic and how subtle she was trying to be with what she says. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that doesn't always come across. I have a much bigger problem with Little Women, where Jo spends the entire book, I want to be a writer, I'm going to sell stories to the American Eagle, and she goes to New York, and then at the end of that, she ends up marrying Professor Bear. Professor Bear, cool, like him, seems to be really nice, but in books like that, where the characters actually, Jo published a novel, they say two of them, I think by the time she marries, the end by the time she marries Professor, so stories like that where there's a lot more development of the female protagonist as someone with her own, you know, thoughts and dreams and professional aspirations. Books like that that then shift it towards, okay, well, you know what? She's totally cool not being married. And there's even a part in there where she says, oh, at the end when they're in the orchard picking apples and they're all talking, the whole family's together. And she's like, yeah, I think back about all those dreams that I had when I was 15. And, you know, they were so cold and barren. I'm so much happier now. I'm not saying that you can't be happy, but then to retcon everything that this character has been working towards for three quarters of the novel because she's lonely and say, okay, that the marriage now is the thing, that's what annoys me more.
That's exactly what I'm referring to. Every single one of the characters that I read growing up gave up her dreams to either assist her husband or just not have her own career entirely. The Meigs, the Joes, the Annes, all of them, without exception. And I'm not blaming this on Jane Austen. I think maybe she may have done it a little bit too well, so that everyone that came after her was following her
example. Formula for,
exactly,
for writing novels.
Because she did it so well that people admired her, they wanted to imitate it. But the fact is that girls grow up seeing this story over and over again. Nothing that you want, nothing that you do matters. The whole point is to get a husband, have children, and that's it. Everything else is just childhood dreams that will go away as soon as you meet the right person, quote unquote. And both of you know that Solas was not exactly my favorite thing in the world, but
because
that's
kissing books.
But I did appreciate at the end, she didn't just wind up with a husband at a massive house. She also wound up with a government position that wasn't exactly her ambition. It was more given to her on a silver platter like everything else was, but at least it was something. It wasn't just marriage, end of story. It was marriage and also the possibility of more adventures. And that's something I liked about the 1995 adaptation as well of Persuasion. I like seeing them on the boat together.
That was a nice touch. Yeah.
So Anne got some adventure along with her typical ending.
Yeah, the ending of 2007 always bothered me when he's taking her out of the carriage and showing her to the house. Number one, that's not how the book ended. He's still in the Navy. He still has money to make. Mm-hmm. And number two, yeah, it kind of takes away that idea of, like, yes, they're going to be together as equals. She's doing something different and new with her life. Because the ending of 2007 just kind of seems as if, okay, well, the house that you grew up in, like, that ancestral pile is no more. Here is a new ancestral pile for you. I think it kind of goes back to what you were saying, where it shows as if she's a little bit more in tune with the family's views than having her own. So yeah.
How does that even work? Is he renting it from her father? What were the logistics there?
So I think, and I could be wrong, because again, the 2007 takes liberties with this. I think he's renting the place where his brother used to live.
Yes.
Which was on the property. So he is letting it. Yeah. They're leasing their house.
That's exactly what Walter Elliott would do. Charge his own daughter for living in her house.
Yes.
And can we just say too, while we're at, well, I guess not at the catharsis corner.
Oh, let's
okay,
go in.
Let's dive okay. in.
One of the biggest problems that I have with the 2007 version of Persuasion, I have both that one and the 95, I watch them fairly regularly, but the running scene. What in God's name? She is 27 years old. She is a gentlewoman. She would not be freaking running around Bath. Where is he? Where is he? For, it seemed like 20 minutes. I was so annoyed. I almost stopped it and missed the whole reconciliation at the end because I was just like, this is ridiculous.
It's memorable because, as I said in First Impressions, that was literally the only thing I remember from the adaptation. The
but
fact
it's
that
so wrong!
Running, it's terrible. It's like Jason Bourne meets Jane Austen.
That's what I'm saying. There's so many other things one should remember about Persuasion. The fact that that's stupid running scene is what sticks in people's minds because you said it's very memorable.
It's a very interesting interpretation of like a whole third of the novel into what, like 2 minutes of running?
Because what are the odds that everyone that she needs
everybody
to speak
happens
to just happens
road.
To be out on that scene?
It is bad.
Including Mrs. Smith, who
it
can't even
bad.
Walk.
Yeah, Mrs. Smith's supposed to be better written. You're right. I can't with that one. It's...
And I had forgotten about that completely until I watched it again. And I had just read the book. So I'm watching this and I'm like, how did they compile everything into this? Like, all the everything that Mrs. Smith confesses just happens in, like, one section where she's like, stop, I must tell you something. She, like, spills all the beans, and then Anne keeps running and running and running and runs some more and run into somebody else and runs. And it's like, it was a frenzy.
That adaptation was desperately trying to mimic the 2005 Pride and Prejudice, but it failed miserably. I did not care for
the
adaptation.
There was a lot of rain. Both of them.
The rain, the music score with the heightened piano that overwhelms all the atmospheric noise, the aesthetics.
Which the 2007, I think it was 2007, adaptation of Sense and Sensibility, if you guys have seen that
yes.
one, much better because it's a mini series, mm-hmm. so you've got like 6 hours to work with and it stays fairly true to the book. So I don't
yes.
know what was happening with this.
And I liked all the characters who played all the people, which is rare.
Right, question, because we actually had on Twitter, we had someone discussing the merits of Ciaran Hinds versus Rupert Penry-Jones, a brunette versus a blonde Wentworth. Do we have any thoughts on this? Just out of curiosity, because she was very, very much, she liked Rupert Penry-Jones because he was blonde and it fit her idea of Wentworth perfectly.
I judge Austen heroes by how well they smolder. And oh. 2007 was a better smolderer.
He does have a good smolder.
I do like his smolder. Can okay. we talk about Tangled?
You broke my smolder.
I would be happy to talk about Tangled anytime.
I would love to. Okay, so B has lots of grievances to air, so I think we should jump into this.
You make it sound like I didn't like this.
No, we've all, I think the newbie has had all the feels on every one of our episodes.
Because they're
which
fresh.
Which makes sense,
because
it's
they're
new
fresh,
to you.
Right. And it's a fresh response. You've had time to process your feelings.
We've read this too many times.
I've read the book and watched both adaptations in the last 3 days, so I have so
Persuasion
many emotions
overload.
Brimming. I did want to talk about something, and that's about Sense and Sensibility. It's not the novel, but the nouns, or what we would call cognitive and affective responses in today's language. Basically, what you think versus how you feel about a work. The best works, as we know, function on both the cognitive and affective levels, obviously. But I think you can still appreciate works that only work for you on one of these levels. Personally, however, a work needs to function for me on an affective level in order for me to really love it. And that's where my catharsis corner secondary rant comes in, I suppose. The thing about Jane Austen's novels is that cognitively, I could not appreciate them more. But effectively, they sort of leave me a little bit wanting more. Essentially, I think they're works of genius, but they don't really give me the feels. And I know this is grounds for immediate dismissal from the circle, so I've
She's
brought
banned.
Backup in the form of Charlotte Bronte and Virginia Woolf. Bronte wrote of Austen that the passions are perfectly
oh,
unknown
Bronte
to her.
Hated Austen.
Bronte hated
yeah,
Austen.
That was way harsh, Ty. But I kind of see your point. And Woolf wrote that she would give all Austen ever wrote for half of what the Brontes wrote. But at the same time, she qualified that statement by adding, if my reason did not compel me to see that she is a magnificent artist. Which, that's pretty much how I feel about Jane Austen. Woolf also wrote that Jane Austen is thus a mistress of much deeper emotion than appears upon the surface. She stimulates us to supply what is not there. So is that my problem with your novels? Am I unable to supply what is not there? Because I don't think I'm heartless. So what am I missing? Help me understand, because I know how much you two love this book and this romance, as we discussed in the shipboard segment, and I don't really get it. Help me.
I think it is that filling in part. I think a lot of what I find, that feeling that every time I read it, it's a new book for me. I've read it at least once every, I would say, like 5 to 10 years. So it's a different book every time. I bring my own experience to it, and I think that's the affective layer that I'm adding to it. Because I appreciate the writing, and I appreciate, and I love the Brontes too. So, like, and they're completely different. I love that on a different level. But when I read Jane Austen, I usually read it because I want to cry. So let's just start with that. It's usually because I'm in a funk and I want to cry. So I'll do that. But yeah, I think I'm bringing something to it myself. I think I'm filling in the details and analyzing it in my own way.
I think for me, I probably read it every year or so. I go through my Jane Austens and give myself like a month and just power through all of them. And for Persuasion, I always leave towards last because it's my favorite. And I think for me, it's because it's the book that, I think it's the book that for me is the most real. How many people fall in love at 17 or 18 or 20 and that's their true love? Or how many people have really dramatic scenes where you fall down a cliff and then you're rescued and then your rescuer turns out to be a brigand and then your secondary rescuer is your true love? You know what I mean?
That's just a Tuesday for me.
That's just a Tuesday.
You guys live much cooler lives than I do.
Because you're reading Austen all the time.
I have a very boring, yes, I'm sitting in my wingback chair, just, you know, like, pages. But you know what I mean? Like, I feel like with the rest of them, I love them, but those are almost more fairy tales for me. Given, yes, obviously the social economic context, I would never actually want to be in that one because, like Bea said, I like to vote and wear pants and all that stuff. But the feeling I get from the rest of them is more fairy tale, whereas with Persuasion, the feeling I get from it is that it's real, because you know what? I make mistakes. I like second chances. Who in real life is as silly as Mrs. Bennet? I have trouble finding people at that level in real life, but I can turn around and give you people who are stuck up and selfish, like
Walter
and Elizabeth. So I feel like the characters are more realistic, and I feel like that's something that could happen to me at any time.
I think one of the things I love most about the 2007 is the portrayal of Mary. Because she's so, like, you know, like, but she reminds me of, like, so many people I have met in real life where it's like, nobody wants to hang out with me. And then the minute they invite her, it's like, I'm fine, I'm going to the party.
For me, it's the opposite. I'm like, oh my God, no one hangs out with me. And then people invite me. I'm like, oh, actually, I want to stay home and read more Austen. But I think maybe that's what it is for me, that I feel like that one is the most true to life. And because I feel so true to life, I have, like, an emotional attachment to it, because, oh, this is something that could happen to any of my friends or to my family. So
I get it now. I don't like realistic things.
Oh, that? Okay, have we?
you've solved it.
Is it?
Thank you.
But, like, I mean, I think it's most realistic. So that, if you don't like realistic things, then I think we have...
You solved it.
Have we answered the question?
We answered the question. Found the clue.
I'm thinking, I read Pride and Prejudice in high school, like I said, and I really enjoyed it. And then I saw the 95 adaptation. I enjoyed that as well. It's one of my sick day movies, which doesn't sound like a compliment, but no, it completely is.
We all
is.
Have those.
Yeah, when you're feeling horrible, you want a movie to make you feel good. So yes, total compliment.
And I felt both of those at the cognitive level, but not really the effective one. And then the 2005 adaptation came along. I have seen that movie at least once a year ever since I first saw it, usually twice a year. I have seen that First Proposal at least twice as many times, because if it's playing and you were on TV, I will stop. I will hold my breath. I will sit at the edge of my seat and I will absorb myself in that scene. It's not realistic.
At all. Yeah.
So I think maybe that's it. I like that heightened melodramatic veneer to Austen.
Fairy tale kind of.
That's it. I grew up on fairy tales. Disney ruined me.
Disney has so much to answer for.
I know.
Okay, but I feel better because now I feel we have not redeemed Persuasion, but we have explained why maybe it doesn't. Yes. Okay. I think that was a good catharsis corn.
So before we get into our reading recommendations, let's give Persuasion a suck rating. Newbie?
I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5.
That's not too bad.
That's not too bad at all.
That's not too bad.
No, I liked it. I enjoyed it. Again, cognitively, I think it's a masterpiece. It's just emotionally, I didn't really connect with this particular story, as I said.
Dissonance for you.
But I have no qualms in recommending this book to everyone. Read it. It's the work of genius.
So as we know, this is my crying book. I love it, and I go to it whenever I need it, so I will give it a 4 rather than a 5, because I do think that I like Pride and Prejudice better when I need the cheerful moment, so I'm going to balance it out. I would give Pride and Prejudice the 5. I'll give Persuasion the 4. But it's still one of my favorite books ever.
And I'm going to give it a 5 because I really, really like it. Like I said, I reread it at least once a year, probably more. And it's my favorite Jane Austen. So I feel very confident in my 5 rating.
4 out of 5 socks? Wow.
That might be our highest rating.
That is definitely our highest rating.
Highest rating.
Lady Jane, who was surprised.
If you are a Jane Austen fan, you have probably read all the published novels, but what you may not know is that she had 2 more novels in the works, which I mentioned earlier, Sanditon and The Watsons, and both of these show the range of her writing and will leave you completely bereft knowing that they will never be finished. They are definitely worth a read, and there are a few people who've kind of like taken them up and tried to complete them. There's a couple of good adaptations that people have worked on. On a less tragic note, I recommend A.S. Byatt's Possession, which has all the romance of an Austen novel with the nerdness of historical sleuthing. It has the bittersweet feel of Persuasion with a dash of what-if romance, and there's a film featuring Jennifer Ely of the 1995 Pride and Prejudice fame that does a really good job of adapting what is a very complex novel. It won the Man Booker Prize, so this is as literary as you can get. If you're a manga fan, on the other hand, you might like to try Emma by Kaoru Mori, or the anime adaptation of the same name. This is unrelated to Austen's Emma, but it is sure to please fans of Austen and Bronte. They may be different. They may not have liked each other, but their works could have worked for the same kind of reader. So think of it as Jane Eyre with a less sinister subplot.
Ooh. I actually just started reading Emma completely unrelated to this, so totally agree. I think I've done the first 2 volumes and I'm waiting for the 3rd one to come from the library. So yes, thumbs up for Emma. If you haven't read Longbourn by Jo Baker, I would really recommend that one as well. It's the story of Pride and Prejudice from the servant's perspective, which is something that I never actually thought of. I was guilty of that before I read the book because they're there, but no one ever thinks about them. And realistically, I probably would have been the one to stay home and do the sewing and not go off to the ball. I probably would have been one of the servants and not one of the Bennet sisters if I was living back then. So it's essentially Austen meets Downton Abbey, and it's really interesting.
I thought surely one of you would mention Lady Susan. No one's going to vouch for Lady Susan? Jane Austen's first anti-hero?
Yeah.
I will vouch for Lady Susan. I love that she wrote a character who's just so despicable and so appealing on that, oh my gosh, this woman is terrible level. But my initial recommendation this time is a short story, The Jay Knights by Rudyard Kipling, which you can find in his collection Debits and Credits. Like all the best works, it is both funny and sad, about an unexpected group of Jane Austen fanatics that just might give you a new perspective on her works. The reason I'm recommending it for Persuasion in particular is that these Jane Knights have very strong opinions on the rankings of her novels, and Persuasion is their clear frontrunner.
I'm intrigued.
And neither of us had ever heard of this story.
I know, it was crazy.
So now we have homework to do ourselves.
Look at that, the newbie contributed something. I know.
Join us next time for episode 4.5, where we will share our favorites, feedback, and first impressions, and announce the next title in the Blue Stockings lineup. In the meantime, you can find us at thebluestockingcircle.com, on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and Tumblr at Blue Sox Circle, that's Blue S-O-X Circle, or email us at thebluestockingcircle@gmail.com. And we are now also available on Apple Podcasts and Google Play, so please rate, review, and subscribe to help us grow.
Cheers!
So, though Persuasion is my favorite Austen novel, it was the last of her completed works that I read. Pride and Prejudice.
You know, that's talking about I feel that could be one of, like, though, you know, they always do, like, Bride and Prejudice, like, Pride and Prejudice, like, the story of a nun or something.
This is terrible.